All right, will you open your Bibles, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 13. 1 Let's try to get everybody on board before the train pulls out here. We're in a series on stewardship. We've said that stewardship can be looked on as a number of ways. It can be looked on as a believer's relationship to the Lord or the lordship of Christ in the believer's experience. That is, stewardship is not an exercise in fractions or moving a decimal point on a dollar figure, but it's a homework assignment in a Christian way of life, how we're going to live for the Lord. Stewardship often focuses in on finances and giving, and so we spent a number of sessions on what the Bible teaches about the believer handling his finances, debt, saving, etc. And the last three messages have been on giving. Now today I want to try to clear up some things if I can. I've never heard a message on what we're talking about today except one that I gave, and I didn't hear it because I was speaking. I'm going to talk today about receiving support, okay? Receiving support. You'll often hear messages from pastors or Christian workers on giving, but I think you'll find you'll rarely hear one on this. For starters, we're going back almost to where we began in 1 Corinthians 9, and we're going to review, first of all, the two basic concepts of Old Testament and New Testament with one primary concept behind it. That is, the authority of gospel workers to receive support. By the way, you may have some questions about this. And it's the hardest thing on Sunday morning to get a question out of anybody. Everybody comes with the idea they're going to sit there. And if you have a question, I'd like to clear it up now. Maybe a kind of a question maybe somebody else has. Don't wait till after the service to ask me. Ask me the question during the service. You can stop me anytime. You stick your hand up. Don't wave it. You'll scare people away. I'll be glad to try to answer the question. Okay? All right. We're going to have a little review. We're going to review 1 Corinthians 9, 13, and 14. We started here. Message number 2 was on this paragraph. Do you not know that they which minister about the holy things live of the things of the temple? It's obvious he's talking about the Old Testament economy, Mosaic economy, and the Levitical priesthood in the temple. And they which wait on the altar are partakers with the altar. All right? Let's divide this up. Because verse 14 compares that with New Testament gospel workers. Even so hath the Lord ordained, or thusly hath the Lord ordained, that they which preach the gospel should live ek out from the gospel. So if on the left-hand side we put 9:13, we have Old Testament temple workers. Who were whom? What tribe? Levites. Levites only. The Levites were the only people, the only human beings ever designated by God to receive a tithe. Nobody else in history ever was designated to receive a tithe except the Levites. Now, under that system, you had the law of the tithe. The law of the tithe. It was a taxation system. The matter that was involved was the matter of obedience to the law. Okay? Secondly, under that system, you had minute detail. Minute detail. There were cases we saw when we went over that system where you may be giving as much as 10 to 35% of your income. Moreover, point 3, it was specific. It was specific. It was concrete. You could figure a minimum of 1/10 because the word tithe equaled 1/10. Okay? Now, beyond that, and this is sometimes overlooked, and it shouldn't be, was the fact of free will offerings. In other words, there were not simply in the Old Testament a tithe, and you could get by with that. There was also free will offerings requested from the believers. Fourthly, those offerings were always brought to the Levites before the temple. You would bring it to a Levite wherever he was. After the temple, you would bring it to the Levites, and they would see to it that it got to where it was supposed to go. Now, in contrast to this, the 14th verse is dealing with New Testament gospel workers. The premise is the same, and this is what Paul is trying to do in the context, or the concept is the same. That is, believers in the Old Testament were to support the workers of the temple. Believers in the New Testament are to support gospel workers. So the concept's the same, and that's his big point. But we're trying to show, or we've tried to show in the series, that there is a difference in New Testament giving. So let me go down the New Testament column. Whereas in the temple workers there was a law that was very specific, in the New Testament there is the concept of grace, liberality. Here it's not a matter of obedience to some outward law or some written law. It is a matter of obedience to the Holy Spirit. And the concept that is domineering in the New Testament is the concept of stewardship of our lives. If we could just get the believer thinking in the realm that Christ is Lord, He's Lord of my life, He owns me not only by creation, but He owns me by redemption, and all that I have is His, we would be off to the right start. It seems as though the last part of our anatomy that gets sanctified is the left-hand pocket, the rear pocket of... See, that doesn't work for women. It seems the last part of our anatomy that gets sanctified is the concept of giving. But if we are conscious and obedient in lordship, giving's going to follow. Okay? Secondly, whereas in the Old Testament you have minute detail, when you harvest the field, the first fruits belong to the Lord. You're not to harvest the corners of the field when the horse makes the swing around the corner or the ox makes the swing around the corner. You're to leave the grain in the corner for the poor people. The firstborn of every creature is the Lord's. If you want to keep it, you have to redeem it and pay a certain price. All the minutiae, am I saying it right? Minutiae? It's all spelled out. Whereas when you get to the New Testament, you have general principles. Okay? You have, for example, in 1 Corinthians 16:2, let everyone lay by him in store, as God has prospered him, that there be no gather. On the first day of the week, let everyone lay in store, as God has prospered him. In other words, in 2 Corinthians 9:6, as every man purposed in his heart, so let him give. So you have the concept of purposeful giving. You have the concept of systematic giving. You have the concept of proportional giving. I'd like to say something here about percentage giving. In counseling with young couples that are anticipating marriage, I like to talk a little bit about economics because economics are so important to marriage. And in the reading material that I have the couples do, there is a man who has a formula. And his formula is he starts with 10% belongs to the Lord. 10% belongs to a savings account. Try to live on the other 80%, blah, blah, blah. read an interesting one this week. It said a young couple was deciding. They had two. They decided the three basic things they needed in life was food, shelter, and clothing. But they could only make two options. So the guy told his wife, make any two options you want out of the two. We have to make a choice because we don't have enough money for the third. That's pretty par for the course in terms of housing today. You may find somebody who might encourage you that way and say, percentage giving. I have nothing against percentage giving. I think you have to start somewhere if you're going to be purposeful and systematic in your giving. You have to start with some figure. And you should be consistent in it. But to lock in at a certain figure really it violates the spirit of the New Testament. I think personally, in my own case, God has blessed me so much that if I only gave the Lord 10%, I feel I'd be robbing God. Personally, that's the way I feel. The New Testament says, as God has prospered you, so let him give. So there is no, you see, detail fixed amount. There's no specific concrete. Point three, it is general, you see. It is left to the individual. Okay? All right. Point four. To whom do we give gifts? Well, this is really a Lulu for today. I'll tell you, this is the Lulu question. If you give any money to any organization, electronic media, direct mailing, whatever, your name goes on a mailing list. Now, I worked for one of these large organizations at one time, and occasionally they would sell the mailing list. They would get as much as maybe $1,000 for a mailing list. One time we had 40,000 people on a mailing list. And really bothered me when I found out that these people sell the mailing list. One of the reasons we didn't publish in this church a directory for a long time was we never know who was going to come in, grab a directory out of the rack out there, take it out, and there goes your name on a mailing list. Pretty soon you get bomb blasted through the mail. And then there's always those Christians who are believers, and they don't identify with a local assembly, and they have guilt feelings, and so they get some of these, you know, they get a picture of an orphan in Bangladesh, and the bony arms are there, and the big belly's protruding, and it said, it's your Christian responsibility to give, and there's some verses to back it up, so to speak. And so they begin giving to these organizations. To whom are you going to give? I think the best mental attitude to have in terms of giving is that you do give to individuals. We've said before, and we said it a number of times here in Holly Hills, I'm going to repeat it. I think whatever we give to this structure or this building or this plant, we're giving that for our own comfort. We're giving that so it'll be expeditious to teach God's Word. But it's really for ourselves. It's hard for me to see that as given to the Lord. Now, if you've got the idea that this place is the successor to the temple, and you see this as the holy sanctuary, and you have some of these misguided concepts of what a room is that you teach in, then perhaps you see it that way. You know, this is the house of the Lord. No, you're the house of the Lord. This is just a room in a building that we meet in. We use it for our convenience. You should be conscious of individuals that you feel you would like to support. And it appears to me that the best attitude in the New Testament is that gifts should go to gifted leaders in the body from whom you receive consistent teaching and blessing. Okay? These would include pastor teachers, teachers, evangelists, and so on. Okay. Yeah, question.
Where does that leave a missionary with whom you have knowledge of, but no contact in terms of their missionary in the foreign region?
I think with missionaries, you should take on the attitude that God will bring you in contact with a missionary, specific missionary that He'd like for you to help. He'll bring that to pass. And when you have the opportunity for that contact, one should take advantage of it, meet the missionaries, try to understand what they're doing, see if the Lord lays them on a person's heart so that you can have personal identity with the missionaries. That's idealistic, but I think that's a concept that you have in the New Testament. In other words, in the New Testament, you had local churches. Missionary is like a traveling evangelist. He's also a teacher. He may be a pastor teacher even. Fits the category. You mean this definition here, you mean? Yeah, okay. You may not, that's right. It's possible that you may not get consistent teaching from a missionary. Maybe we should say from whom the Lord brings us into identity. Maybe that would cover the base a little better. I see. You're talking about the definition. Yeah. You have to make a choice. We all make a choice in this matter about whom we're going to support. You couldn't begin to support all the missionaries that asked to speak in Holly Hills. We couldn't begin to even do it. So we try to be very careful about whom we have confront you. We try to filter out people that we feel would not be consistent in terms of an extension of what we're trying to do here. Okay? Yeah, so this perhaps does not include, or this definition is a little anemic in the sense that it would not include those. We definitely believe in supporting missionaries, yeah. But I think there should be a personal identity, you see, with the missionary. I think you have this concept repeated in, again and again in the New Testament. All right? Okay. Yes, question. Uh-huh, Mary? Two questions, and it's only 10:30. Great. Your gift to the Lord? Where's Ken at? How's the financial report, Ken? The question Mary's asking is this. Can we consider, suppose we have somebody that we are friends or something, and that's this person, this family is destitute or in need or shows a consistent need. Could we consider giving to them, giving to the Lord? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I sure do. I think you have to be very careful, however, that you do not make these people dependent on you so that you become like a personal social agency. We have to try to be careful of that in the fellowship here. But I think you could say that, yes, because of the passage in 1 John chapter 3, if you see a brother that has consistent need, you're continually seeing it, and it's continually a consistent need. That makes it very personal. How dwelleth the love of God in you? Yeah, another believer, yeah. Yeah, another believer. Just be careful you're not, you don't make a, you don't become too socialized with the gospel. If you have an identity with a local church, you certainly have responsibility there. So you have to be careful that you don't get out of whack in terms of how you're handling your finances and so on in terms of giving. Let me bring this sort of home to you. Think of the simplicity of the church in the time of Paul. Think of the simplicity of the church. If you went to Corinth and you wanted to go to church, where would you go? You wouldn't have to look in the telephone book and go through. Did you ever look in the telephone book? You know, Heinz 57, Variety of the Baptist. And then you've got Bible church. Now the Bible churches are all, you know, independent Bible church, IFCA Bible church, just Bible church. Even the Bible churches are all hacked up. Think of the simplicity of this in the time of Paul. You didn't have 30,000 arms of the church. Youth for Christ, the Navigators, Young Life. Multitudinous organizations that are supposed to be arms of the church. When I talk to these people that are involved in most of these organizations, they're not even in a local church. It's terribly, terribly disappointing to find that out. The issue of this too, number four today, is extremely, extremely complex. You should look for a solution that keeps you in balance, that you don't shut yourself up, but you don't extend yourself in such a way that you're having meaningless giving. There ought to be some personal feeling and consciousness that I am giving to the Lord and I am supporting this work, and this is the Lord's work as far as I'm concerned. Well, now we're going to do something. We're going to go on to an attitude of Paul, because he just says, in the case of the Corinthians, I forgot all about this. Okay? And I've been waiting to get to this passage ever since we had session number 2. He has set up, by the time you get to verse 15, the issue thus far is the authority of the gospel worker to receive gifts. If you look at verse 3, my answer to them that do examine me is this: have we not power to eat and to drink? Underline the word power. Verse 5, have we not power to lead about a sister or wife as the other apostles? Verse 6, or I only and Barnabas, have we not power to forbear working? The word for power is the word exousia. And exousia means delegated authority. And what Paul is saying is, in verse 4, they have the power or the right to tangible support from believers. In verse 5, they have the right of support, even if they're married, they have the right of support. And in verse 6, they have the right or the authority not to be looking for jobs in order to support themselves. In verse 12, you have the word power written again. If others be partakers of this power or authority over you, are not we rather? And then his principle in verse 12, verse 12, latter part, nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we hinder or cause a block to the gospel of Christ. All right? Then in verse 15, but I have used none of these things. So what he say? He builds a case for authority for the gospel worker, and then he says, in my personal case, I haven't used these things. Well, now wait a minute. Did he really not use those things? Or is he simply talking to the Corinthians about it? I want to try to answer that, and I want to do it in a way that you can follow the logic of verse 15 through 18, make the application, and then we'll look at some other passages. We're now going to deal with Paul's attitudes and the principles of the New Testament, and these are expressed in 9, 15 through 18. First of all, verse 15a, but I have used none of these things. If you want to loop that back to verse 12, nevertheless, we have not used this authority. What hasn't he used? Paul, I don't want to say rejected, he chose. Paul's choice not to use authoritative rights. Okay? Okay. The verb is powerful. The verb have not used is perfect tense. In fact, you have a triple negative here. The concept would be like this if we wrote it in English. Not used, not even one. That's not a triple negative. Well, it is in Greek. You just have to take my word for it. It's a way of emphatically saying that he did not want to use this, and he puts it then in the perfect tense. Okay? Okay. In other words, what Paul is saying to the Corinthians, and these authoritative rights have been mentioned in 4, 5, 6, and 12, the word exousia, this power, see? Okay. Now, what he is saying to the Corinthians was that there was no price tag on my ministry to you people. I did not sit down and compute the cost or stipulate a price. Boy, that is one way to weed out certain people in involvement in the gospel. When I call somebody and ask them to speak here, I have never run into this yet. Any speaker that you've ever had here, bar none, when I've called them, there has never been a mention of money, except unless I bring it up. I'll not forget the first time I called Henry Morris, and I didn't know him from Adam personally. And I managed to get his phone number, this very, very famous man, worldwide fame. And I got him on the phone, and we just talked as though we had known each other all our life. And I had 3 weeks picked out, plan A, B, C. And plan A was a week that was compatible with his schedule. And he never once mentioned money at all. Same way with every speaker you've ever had in this church. When a person starts putting a price tag on their ministry, they are violating principles of the New Testament that ought not to be violated. I don't blame a guy if he goes somewhere to speak and he pays his own expenses and then he's not remunerated for his expenses if he doesn't go back. I don't blame a guy at all for that. But there is a problem when people put a price tag on their ministry. What Paul was saying was when it came to ministry to the Corinthians, there was a choice not to use that authoritative right. Okay? Point two. This is verse 15b. Neither have I written these things that it should be so done unto me. In other words, there are no subtleties. There are no subtleties now with Paul. In other words, he's not writing to them in order to raise a guilt complex because they hadn't supported him. They hadn't given unto him. He says, I'm not trying to subtly get you to support me by writing these things. Paul was not worried about security on this earth. The only thing he was worried about was opportunity. He wanted to take opportunity of the moments that he had. So he's not trying to stir these people up in terms of some future subtle thing that he has in mind in supporting himself. And it's remarkable how easy it is for a person in Christian ministry to try to get empathy from people by little subtle things that one says, you know. I'm so poor. We're poor all the time. Look at all these cheap suits I wear. Pastor goes to lunch with somebody and never pays the bill. It's a disgrace. People ought to support a pastor where he doesn't feel like he's going to have to do that. And he ought not to be in that think where, you know, a pastor is like he's a social parasite. Don't make your pastor feel that way. Well, I don't care where you are. I'm not just talking about Holly Hills. It's ridiculous. It ought not to be. And what happens under sometimes under those situations, you get a thumb sucker, and then he's always laying on you what poverty level he lives at. So in order to stimulate you to do something about it. Paul was not worried about security. He was worried about opportunity. So he's not now trying in this letter to stir up guilt. Okay, point three. Now, there was a rationale, and this rationale has to be applied to the Corinthians. This is the rationale now of Paul. In this policy with the Corinthians. We have to qualify something here. It was the normal policy of Paul to receive gifts. We're going to see that. That was normal. His policy with the Corinthians was abnormal. There was, however, one aspect of that policy that was normative, and that was in the initiation of the gospel. It was always free. Never was there any effort to raise monies in terms of the initiation of the gospel in a place. That would be a disgrace to the gospel. Okay? Okay. This is his logic now in making the gospel without charge. This policy refers to making the gospel without charge. I was talking to Chet McCauley this week. We were talking about our saturation weekend, and he was here. He was here in June, and I was telling him how lousy his overhead projector screen was. I asked him if we were going to show that movie, you know, the movie we saw. And I said, we're going to have to show that movie in that lousy cubbyhole of a screen you got up there. When are you going to get that thing straightened out? And he said, yeah, I was really impressed with sitting in the congregation and seeing your use of the overhead, he says, with the screen, how magnificent it is. He said, if you could only learn to write. This was the kind of thing he was referring to, in case you haven't picked up on that yet. All right. If you can't read, just raise your hand and ask a question. See, maybe we'll get some response. All right, the first thing he does is he talks about a boast, a glory. And this glory has to do with the Corinthians. You will not hear him ever make this boast in any other book. He makes this with the Corinthians. And what was the glory? 15c. Let's read the verse in its entirety. But I have used none of these forms of authority, neither have I written these things, that it should be so done unto me, that you should be given to me. For, because, I won't do this because it were better for me to die. That's a little exaggerated, I think, but he's trying to make a point. Than that anyone should make my glorying or my boasting empty. All right? So his point is that he has something he takes pride in. I take pride in this policy with you. Underline the last two words, with you. It is something he is proud of. Okay? Okay. Now, what was the policy? What is he talking about? He is talking about, again, the policy is making the gospel without charge. As we work through the context, you'll see that. Verse 18 says, what is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. In order to settle this once and for all, what this is, we can look at 2 Corinthians. Here he defines it, chapter 11, verses 7 through 10. So just to hold your place here and look at chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians. He makes reference now to this policy. Now, remember that 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 are the two most extant sections on giving in all of the New Testament. He's coming at these people in terms of giving, but not to himself. He wants them to give to a special collection for believers in Jerusalem. Now he mentions himself in 11:7. Have I committed an offense in, and that word offense is the word hamartia, which means sin, in abasing myself that you might be exalted because I have preached the gospel to you freely or without charge. Now watch. I robbed other churches, taking wages of them. Will you mark that? Because that's going to be a principle. That word is opsonion. We'll look at it later. The word opsonion means a stipend. It is the kind of stipend that a military soldier received monthly in the Roman army. The word is used in Luke 3:13, where John the Baptist had to remind the military people, be satisfied with the wages you get. I know that's difficult for military. It was then, it still is, and I can understand why. But nevertheless, it is the word for wages. It means Paul took a stipend from churches, a monthly committed amount. Let's not get off on a track on that. He just says here he did that, and he was taking money from them so that he could minister to the Corinthians. And when I was present with you and I wanted or was in extreme need, I was chargeable to no man. I didn't even borrow. For that which was lacking to me, the brethren which came from Macedonia supplied. In other words, the churches in Thessalonica and Berea and Philippi came down and brought some money to me. And in all things I have kept myself from being burdensome to you, and so will I keep myself. As the truth of Christ is in me, no man shall stop me of this boasting in the regions of Greece. Wherefore? Or why? Because I don't love you? God knows what I do. But what I do, that I will do, that I may cut off occasion from them which desire occasion, that wherein they glory, they may be found even as we. In other words, found with the same purity of motive that we have. In other words, what he is saying is, in 2 Corinthians, is simply that no one can question my purity or the purity of motive. No one can question my purity as long as I follow this policy. Now, the problem was at Corinth was that somebody was doing that. And they were consistently doing it. They kept on doing it. And this bugged Paul so much that he just kept on refusing to take support from them. It was a very, very unique case. Okay? Any questions about that? So that when he was in Greece, and this tale was following him around, that he was preaching for money, or that he was handling the gospel for money, he could say, huh, no way. Wouldn't take a cent from this people here. Okay, back to chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians and verse 16. Now he talks about the motivation in terms of his ministry. Motivation. Verse 16. Here he's going to talk about the necessity to gospelize. I'm coining a word here. Gospelize. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of or boast of. The reason that I have nothing to boast of is that necessity is laid or is placed upon me. In other words, my function and my role in terms of the gospel is not something that I chose, but something that was laid upon me by the Lord. Yea, woe is unto me if I do not preach the gospel. So you have the concept of necessity. Necessity. A constraint. A compulsion. Compulsion. Why? Due to Christ's choice. And Paul's very comfortable with that choice. He's happy that he's an apostle. He's comfortable in his functional role in the church. And the Lord Jesus had made him feel that necessity. And the same thing will be true of you if you're going to be involved in gospel ministry. You will feel that compulsion, that constraint, that tremendous desire that you want to communicate the things of the Lord. Preaching of the gospel is not a matter of glorying, Paul is saying to me. It is a matter of necessity. Need is placed upon me by another, so that woe is me if I do not do it. Okay? Keep reading, because this is sometimes a little difficult to follow. Particularly verse 17. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. Verse 17 explains verse 16. And I think the King James confuses it a little by using the word unwillingly. It looks like Paul's will may not have been involved in the communication of the gospel. The point in verse 16 is, this is a first-class conditional sentence. And I think the thing that clarifies the issue mostly is the word that is translated unwillingly or willingly. Okay. If I do this willingly, let me show you the two words. Unwillingly. Okay. Willingly is simply the word ekon or hekon. H-E-K-O-W-N. Where unwillingly in the King James is akon. A-K-O-N. And what this simply means is voluntarily. Where akon would be involuntarily. You may volunteer to be a communicator of the gospel, and you'll get a certain blessing out of doing that. You'll have a terrible time being consistent and following through in it, unless you are chosen by the Lord to do that. And that is what Paul is saying when he said he did it involuntarily. Because he was chosen by another. Chosen by the Lord to gospelize. Now, since that is true, since one is chosen by the Lord to do this, then a dispensation, and here is our beautiful word, because this is true, this results in or equals stewardship of the gospel. Okay? Okay, so what did he say in verse 16? He said in verse 16 there was a necessity, a need, a constraint, a compulsion. Why? Because Christ chose him to do it, and when he did, he became responsible as a steward or an overseer of the gospel. Believe this, that Paul's will was involved. The passage is simply teaching that he was chosen by the Lord for the job. Just like if you have upward mobility in your job situation. And let's say they need a manager in your job situation. And they come to you and they say, we have been watching you. We think you have certain skills as a manager and we have an opening. We would like you to consider that opening. We would like, you are our choice for the job. Your volition is going to be involved. But you have been chosen by somebody else to do it. Same thing is true here. Paul was chosen. He didn't volunteer, did he? you want a good argument for graduate students in college about the validity of Christianity, and the people you're talking to have any sense at all, know anything about the Apostle Paul, just ask them what happened to Paul. How did Paul get involved in what he was doing? Was he a nut?
Here was this guy who was out murdering Christians. He had voted for the death of Stephen. He probably threw a few rocks. He had blood of Stephen on his hands. And he's going up to Damascus, and he's hailing, the King James says, means dragging men and women into prison. And all of a sudden, he is confronted by the Lord Jesus Christ. And he has a 180-degree turnaround. And this guy, who was the devil's mailman, he had a letter from the Sanhedrin saying to arrest these people, becomes the chief propagator of the faith, and the stewardship of the gospel is laid on him. He is responsible. Okay? So he says, so what he's saying in the context, I'm responsible to the Lord for this. I'm not going to worry about the money situation if somebody's giving me a hard time about money. Just forget it. I won't take a dime from you. Okay? That's what he's saying. Okay? Okay. Paul was commanded to preach, and he did it with his whole heart. But he was not commanded to refuse support. He did that of his own accord. That was his own choice. Okay? And that required a special confidence that the Lord would supply for him. See what I'm saying? Okay. Now in the next point, wow, is it that late already? That's impossible. It's 11 o'clock. Verse 18. Here he talks about a reward. What is my reward then, in view of this? And he answers it. That when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not. No one can accuse me of abusing my authority in the gospel. His reward was simply satisfaction. Satisfaction of service to the Corinthians without charge. And I don't know if charge is the right word. Without remuneration, maybe. He never charged. He never charged, but he did teach stewardship. You see? So maybe we shouldn't use the word charge. What is my reward? Okay? That I render the gospel without charge. I made a choice, and I am sticking with my choice until the issues clear up. Now, some people read this passage and they make it the sum total of Paul's practice. It was not the sum total of Paul's practice. to do so and make it that would be to err. And so what I'd like to do in closing is to give you at least 5, maybe 6 principles of New Testament attitudes, most of them expressed by Paul, relative to this business of supporting gospel workers, or if you're a gospel worker, receiving support. And these are principles that are reiterated in the letters of Paul. Are there any questions up to this point? Let's try to answer. Any questions on the passage? Okay. If you're taking notes, these are principles of gospel workers receiving financial assistance. Point one. Now we have point one in the context that we are in. 1 Corinthians 9:12. The principle is simply this. The gospel worker has to ask the question, what action will best promote the work of the gospel? This is a key issue. What action will best promote the work of the gospel? Okay? To refuse support, or maybe to work for less support, for nothing. In other words, you have to get your bread somewhere else. To receive support. There are a number of options open to the believer. You know the one who puts the most pressure on gospel workers in this regard? The people in the pew. There are Christians who think that if a pastor supports himself by some outside work, that he's not much of a pastor. You have a full-time pastor? Does he work somewhere? Do you support him? Gee, how can people take that attitude when men like the Apostle Paul worked to support his gospel team? Don't get sidetracked. Sometimes the best thing may be to refuse support. Sometimes you may have to work for nothing. It's not the best prospect, but it happens. I worked the first 2 years in Colorado, didn't get a dime. 2 years. finally some guy heard me speak in a town 100 miles from here. I didn't know him from Adam. He owned a chicken farm. He says, that guy should be spending all his time teaching. Here's $1,000. Get him started. I didn't even know the guy. I never met him. I haven't met him to this day. It's a key issue that you have to decide. Point two, at times, our gospel workers may receive wages from an established assembly. Or in the case of a missionary, maybe from a number of assemblies. And here is our word in 2 Corinthians 11:8. Wages is the word opsonion. Look it up. O-P-S-O-N-E-O-N. It means a stipend, like as per military. Then it was consistent, it was the same amount. It was consistent, went on, and it came usually at the same time, if they could do it. See? Point three. Third principle. Let's skip that one. Let's just add another, since it's redundant. Let's just put another verse down, Philippians 4:10, where Paul thanks them that their care of him hath flourished again. That is, they were looking out to send him gifts. Point three. Third principle. At times the gospel worker may have to labor with his hands. Now he should, normally his labor or his, the thing that exhausts him, as we were told in 1 Timothy chapter 5, is the work in the Word. He labors to the point of exhaustion in the Word and in doctrine. But here, he may have to labor with his hands. And Paul did this again and again in Acts 20, in dealing with the Ephesian elders, he told them how that he was chargeable to no man. How that he coveted no man's silver of gold, but he labored with his own hands in order to meet his needs. On his second missionary journey, he supported himself, and when he wrote the Thessalonians, he reminded them that he supported his whole gospel team, 1 Thessalonians 2:9. Repeat 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 7 through 9. Why should a gospel worker today consider that to be something unheard of or impossible for them? If Paul had to do it, you know what's happened? What's happened, you see, in Christianity is that we have, this thing that started out so simple has become so complex because of the denominational paraphernalia that you get locked in to a think as to how you're going to get your support. And so people who are concerned about this, if they haven't grown up in a denomination and they get involved in ministry, they're often drawn into a denomination by the security of a denomination. You begin to look to the denomination for security. If you're in Georgia and you're Southern Baptist, you build your house facing Atlanta. If you're in Texas, you build it facing Waco. No, not anymore, I guess. They don't face Baylor. I don't know where you'd face it. If you're Lutheran and you're in the Missouri Synod, you build your house facing St. Louis, Concordia. If you're Methodist, or if you're not a Methodist and you want to get in, they see to it that you get the initiation. And you back up and you get the M stamp, stamped on you. You're theirs for life. And you have security. If you want to move from one town to another, well, we can put you in another church. Sure, we'll move you over here. Security. One time I had a fellow come to me and say, he was about 36, he was aggressive, businessman, had all the status symbols. And, you know, a little cross pen in his pocket, is in an appointment to see me as president of the school. He said, I've been to all the denominational schools and checked out. First of all, he told me, he says, I think the Lord wants me involved in public ministry. I've been to all the denominational schools and to see what they could offer me. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, size of the church. When I get out of school, what type of salary I can expect, and fringe benefits, health plan, so on. He says, now I made the appointment to you to see what you can offer.
Who do you think we are?
passion, care. Did you know a greater figure in Christendom? You see that old gnarly old Jew getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning so he can work with leather and tough hands? Him or not as a leather thing, punching holes in the leather, making saddles and tents and had to be around camels all the time. You think he liked that? He wanted to be reading a scroll of Isaiah.
Thank you.